my fellow creators. May you find inspiration in your lives and work this week. This conversation was between myself and one of the most eminent scholars of the early church fathers, a man who happens to also be my father, Dr. Marcellino the Grayer, as we call him. He is a PhD scholar. He was the valedictorian of Catholic University of America, currently a professor at Catholic Distance University, and is a renowned speaker. And he's also the dad of the coolest five kids in the world that I know. On the real, he runs Crossroads Initiative, which started out of a rock band in the 80s and is now an organization dedicated to helping the world rediscover the adventure of the Christian faith. And here's why I asked him to be on the podcast. One of the conversations that's happened in the group that has been going on in the church as well is centered around the question, how should we deal with culture? How should we deal with secular pagan culture? There is this tension between tradition and creativity. How do we value the treasures of the church that we know and love, while at the same time valuing and adapting to modern culture for the sake of innovation? This tension is especially present when we grapple with conversations about liturgy. For those of us that are sort of struggling with those questions, I wanted to bring Dr. Italy onto the cast so that we could talk about how the early church approached those questions. And the conversation was deeply enlightening. But before we get into that, news. As a community of creators and artists and free thinkers, we are seeing our movement grow in the church dramatically. Unity between artists and different organizations and people within this grassroots coalition is moving forward dramatically, and collaborations between members have skyrocketed in the last year. But for all of us to move to the next level and for us to really see the new Renaissance realized, we need to connect this group of artists to the successful business owners, executives, financiers who can invest in those projects, who dwell and exist outside of the group. So we are working on making that connection happen, and just wanted to let you know that we're going to be looking for those kinds of people to invite to the next summit and to get involved with what we're doing. And if you know anybody that works within that realm and would like to sponsor the projects that we've got coming down the pipe, let's get connected. Let's talk. So, finally, big news. As you know, we've pledged as a community to pick a single project that we believe could make massive impact in culture and that could facilitate collaboration across all types of creatives within this group and really sponsor it and push it forward. So, the news is we have found that project and have been working behind the scenes to get it ready for your involvement. So, we have a huge collaboration stewing for you right now, and we can't wait to tell you about it, and that news is coming in the coming weeks. So, consider this the teaser. But if you want an opportunity to work with amazing people and grow in community and all your skill sets, it's coming. Without further ado, let's get into the podcast. Everybody, welcome to the Catholic Creators Podcast, where we interview people who have awesome things to say that will share them with us, that will inspire us to greater creativity. I'm here with a very important man for the creation of this group, important man for my life, my dad, Dr. Italy Marcellino D'Ambrosio. Dad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be on this podcast at long last.
So, what was your first impression of me, Dad?
Your first impression of you, you were a happy-go-lucky, easygoing baby. That was my first impression of you, Anthony.
Well, I'm glad that despite all of the terrors that I put you through as a melancholic and whining child that woke up all the time, that you would still come on the cast and participate in the community.
I've needed a lot of healing, Anthony, but I think I'm here. I'm ready. I think I've made a lot of progress.
Okay, so you're an expert in historical theology, in the history of the church. And one of the things that I have been super interested to get you on the cast for has been that one of the things that I've seen as a problem for the church in moving into the new evangelization is that right now in the U.S., it really seems like there's two separate schools of thought that are very opposite to each other in the way that we should approach the new evangelization. One being a looking back at pre-Vatican II church, looking back at the sort of 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s in an idyllic way and saying, how can we reinstate that kind of church and that kind of perspective? How can we conserve Latin and be a church that is a people set apart? That is one school of thought. The other one is, how can we enculturate? How can we become a part of this culture and change it from the inside out? Those have different names, right? Like traditionalism versus progressivism, or even just, you know, traditionalists versus charismatics even. There's a lot of different ways of talking about it, but those camps are divisive, and the conversations around them, especially in the theological circles, are also divisive. So I wanted to just bring you on to ask, with your perspective on historical theology, how should the church approach culture and evangelizing and tradition in light of that history?
Anthony, it's a big problem. The problem that you're grappling with and wanting me to address here, but I think one of the things that I'm convinced of is we really can't know how now we are to engage the culture without losing our soul. How we're to maintain the non-negotiables and at the same time be effective in communicating the gospel to the modern world. We can't understand that unless we look at all the periods of the history of the church, and especially at the beginning, to see how the church did it, you know? And I think, unfortunately, that historical perspective is sorely lacking among even fairly well-educated Catholics that I'm running across these days. It just became clear to me that many graduates who've worked really hard and done some theology and philosophy and history in school don't really have the historical perspective they need and the overview of the Catholic tradition. But anyway, I'd love to just like make a few points based on the early church and other greats that people look back to and see how they did it, you know? And I think that helps us understand how we need to do it. One thing I would just point out is, I was just thinking about this today, the very first person that we see engaging the pagan culture in the history of Christianity is Paul. And Paul is mainly dealing with Jews, but then in the Areopagus, Acts 17, he speaks to pagans. And so we see how he does it. And what he does is he finds a point of contact. He says, you have an altar to an unknown God. You're very religious people. And so I want to tell you about the God that you've been worshiping but haven't really known and understood. Now, that's a really critical point. He doesn't get up there and start preaching in Aramaic. He preaches in Greek, and he starts by actually engaging something good in their culture instead of all the bad stuff. And there's plenty of bad stuff to talk about, but instead of getting up and denouncing, he starts with a point of contact. Now, did everybody like what he had to say? When he talked about the resurrection, lots of people walked away. But there were several who came to Christ in that encounter, but it gives us a model of, you know, a little bit about how we are to engage the culture. There's got to be a point of dialogue, and there's got to be a point of openness where we actually see something that's common ground with the culture and its concerns, as perverse as the culture may be. His culture was pretty, you know, the Greco-Roman culture in 60 AD was pretty perverse. I mean, you're dealing with a ruler like Nero, and dealing with, you know, a really corrupt society. And yet, you know, there's a respect there, and there's an openness there to find a point of contact.
So before we get into the points specifically that you want to make about it, let's just give a little bit of background on Dr. Italy, who he is, how he got to be such an authority in this matter. So what got you interested in theology? Was that something you were always into?
Okay, well, first of all, I was a musician, so I could care less about school. I hated school, and I started playing professionally when I was 13, occasionally, and then more seriously at 16.
Playing
I was a bass guitar player in rock bands, and played in a number of clubs. Also played classical, though, not for money, but I was a classical musician as well. So, you know, jazz, I was in a big jazz band, 1950s band. So I was pretty Catholic, you know, with a small C, in my musical taste, but I was a professional rock musician. So I was looking to go to music school. I was not interested in theology or philosophy or anything else. I was more than a nominal Catholic, but not a disciple as a kid. And I had an encounter with Christ. I saw other people who changed their lives dramatically and were living what I saw to be a greater adventure than the adventure of the hippie world and rock and roll, which was my life. And so the Lord grabbed me. He grabbed my heart. I saw following him is the most incredible thing in the world. I understood that he had a special call for my life. And I thought it was the priesthood. It wasn't. It was to be a lay minister, a lay teacher. And that led me to a doctorate in theology. But all along, I'm not the kind of, you know, egghead that just wants to sit in an ivory tower and read about the past or read about, you know, great thoughts. I'm interested in the life of the church now and how I can take from the past food that can nourish the church and transform the church and renew the church now.
And so how did you move from being in a rock band to becoming a professor of theology? Like, what was the story in between?
Well, it was definitely not an overnight move, Anthony.
What's the secret?
I was hanging around with a bunch of teens and millennials that were on fire for Christ and got into spiritual direction and started praying the Liturgy of the Hours.
Teens and millennials. Yeah, you're hanging out with millennials.
Well, no, I'm sorry, not millennials, 20 somethings. Yeah, millennials hadn't been born yet. You're right, Anthony.
It's impressive.
But yeah, it's pretty good, huh? But anyway, you know what I mean. So I was hanging out with a lot of young people. The point is there was a tremendous movement in, this is 1971, of the Holy Spirit. And there were a lot of young people and old people. And it's the fascinating thing is it was just an explosive kind of moment in the life of the church. But in that moment, there were a great integration with the fullness of the ancient tradition of the church. Some of the people involved in that movement were theologians and were, you know, were people deep in the spiritual life. My spiritual advisor was a Trappist monk 20 years in the monastery who turned me on to the fathers of the church and turned me on to St. Thomas and turned me on to, of course, the scriptures first and foremost and the sacraments. So I just was just blown away by how much was there, and I was learning and growing. And that kind of led me into the seminary and then into theology school.
And when you were studying theology, I mean, obviously, I know a lot of these stories, but one of my favorite things to do as a child was to go and watch 80s music videos of your band, your Christian band. Could you tell me a little bit about Crossroads?
Sure. I was working in campus outreach.
I mean, you had a mullet.
I had a mullet, yes. I was. First of all, when I had an experience of coming, you know, falling in love with the Lord, I still was playing professional rock music for another year, and then once that band folded, I said good riddance, and I was more interested in Gregorian chant than I really was in contemporary music at that point in time, because I was just, you know, immersing myself in the tradition. So anyway. What happened is later I got involved. I'm finishing my PhD. I'm in my 20s. I'm working in evangelization on college campuses. And a friend of yours, Father Bill Baer, who at that point wasn't Father, he was just Bill Baer, he said to me and to another guy, my friend George, hey, listen, we're not getting people showing up for these evening lectures you guys are doing. Maybe that's because kids are tired of lectures. They've been in class all day. You guys are musicians. Can't you do something more creative? Can't you come up with a musical event where you share the gospel? So anyway, a band was born called Crossroads, and we weren't just performers. We were using music as a platform. The songs communicated, but we communicated between the songs and did a lot of storytelling. So that was that led us all over the country. We were doing lots of concert kind of retreat things, particularly for Catholic high schools. Had a captive audience. They hit them between the eyes with something they didn't expect. And it was really exciting and powerful time, really.
Okay, so it's the 80s, traveling around, the band, rocking out, and also studying to be a doctor in theology at the same time? Like, was that a hard balance to strike? How'd you do both those things?
Well, honestly, I didn't make much progress on my dissertation while I was traveling around the country doing with a rock band. So, that band folded after many years because it was kind of tough having, you know, kids like you and your brother and your sister at home and me being on the road. So anyway, we did our best to keep it going for a while. And then we folded it and I ended up focusing on the dissertation. So, I had to switch gears in order to get it done.
So back to the question then, I mean, you were doing evangelization in a creative way, which I think has really affected the way that I've approached doing ministry and looking at like enculturation. But you had a very rich like theological foundation for understanding that as you were doing it in a way that I think would be really valuable for me to hear more about. So what in your studies really struck you as like moments that you could look back at and say, yeah, I'm doing what the early church fathers would have advised. Like, this is how they would have done it.
Well, first, I just want to say what you just said, I'm doing what the early church fathers did. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Because what the early church fathers did, and even Thomas Aquinas did, was very creative exercise. They took the tradition and had to articulate it to their generation, which was different than the Palestinian, or, you know, Judean, Galilean people that Jesus preached to. You know, they're in an urban environment. They're in a Greco-Roman world, and so they used categories from philosophy to share the timeless message of the gospel. And Aquinas, you know, he takes something new that was controversial, a new form, the latest rage in intellectual life, you know, the thought of Aristotle, and he marries it to the tradition and comes up with a new synthesis. You know, he articulates the gospel in a new way. He was a very progressive kind of a guy, and a lot of people condemned him for it, actually, in his day. And so anyway, I felt like what I need to do is not just write about what they did, but I got to do it. You know, I got to articulate the gospel in language that today people can understand today. But it's the timeless gospel. It's the richness and the fullness of the Catholic tradition. No compromise, no cutting corners. You know, it's got to be, the fullness has got to be there. So that's really kind of what I've aimed to do throughout my life and my writing and my speaking and all.
So when we were starting, you had said that you had a few points that you wanted to make about that tension between tradition and creativity and newness. What were some of those insights that you wanted to share with us?
Well, one of the areas where I have expertise is what led up to the Second Vatican Council and the Council itself. And that's right at the center of controversy. You know, there's a lot of people who, in the name of the council, did wacky things and threw out devotions and all sorts of stuff. And then there's people who react against them and figure, well, if they're representing the council must have been bad. So we got to go back to the way things were before. But I want to just tell you what that was really about, because it hits on true creativity, Christian creativity, whether it be artistic or theological or anything else. And that is the people who led up to the council were a bunch of very amazing people. And John Paul II and Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, are fans of those folks. And, you know, some of those folks were made cardinals. They're priests only, but they were made cardinals after the council because of the debt the church owed to them.
What were some of their names?
Some of the names was Henri de Lubac, on who I wrote my dissertation. He's a French Jesuit. Another is Yves Congar, who was a Dominican. Von Balthasar was an important figure, and many people know his name, Hans Urs von Balthasar. Louis Bouyer is another guy. So some of these people were very important folks, but here's what they came up with before the council, and the council relied in large part on them. The only way the church can be really effective in this new pastoral situation is, first of all, to engage people today and really take their questions and their problems seriously. And then take those questions back to the great sources of the tradition and let us interrogate, you know, the tradition with the problems of today, and we'll get new insights. We'll see new things in the riches of our tradition and from the power of communion with the ancient tradition, seeing it with new eyes, we come back to do new things, for new creativity to sprout forth, to surge forth out of that encounter with the sources, with the scriptures, with the fathers, with the ancient liturgies, with St. Thomas, with all the places and people where the Catholic tradition is most vital and most alive. Okay, so tradition really is the key to true progress or true growth and true creativity. Tradition is a progressive force. It's not a retrograde kind of force. They were all against a slavish copying of the past. And there are some people who want to copy the New Testament past. Particularly, this has been a problem with some Protestants. Can't do anything except the way it was done exactly in New Testament times, you know? There's other people who want to copy the way things were done in the 1950s, okay? With just all the outward accoutrements of, you know, vestments to, you know, language to songs to everything. And that really misses the mark of what tradition and true traditionalism is, okay? And I already made the point that Aquinas was amazingly progressive because he took the tradition and didn't just repeat what everyone else did. He integrated something new based on the rage of modern thought, which was Aristotle. He saw some things there that really could help to rearticulate and organize and systematize the faith and the way it was taught and explained. And that was a great move forward. So really what we need now is, you know, really an authentic traditionalism, not a slavish copying of the past. And that's what Renaissance is all about. You know, Renaissance in the 15th, 16th century, Michelangelo didn't just copy the Greeks. He studied them. He learned the great spirit of the classical sculptors, but then he did something new out of that. You know, he did something creative. He synthesized the Christian spirit and, you know, the 15th century spirit. And if you look at a Greek statue from the time of Plato, it looks pretty different from what Michelangelo came up with. So anyway, that's what needs to happen today in evangelization and in Catholic culture.
Yeah, I mean, we've in the group talked about the new Renaissance a lot and have this vision for bringing about a new wave of beauty, a new creative culture. And like I said, I think one of the biggest obstacles to that is figuring out how to navigate the questions of how do we engage with culture without losing ourselves? You know, what in your perspective are ways that we can approach that problem? Like, how do we think about that problem? How do we enrich without losing ourselves? Or how do we like free ourselves from having to be slavish copiers of the past?
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty simple principle. Pope John the 23rd clarified and enunciated right at the beginning of the Second Vatican Council. He said, the truth of the gospel is one thing. The way it's communicated is another. You talk about content and packaging, you know, that's another metaphor. But the doctrine of the faith and the morality of the faith, these things are non-negotiables, but the way in which you express them can be really different from age to age. John Paul II took traditional Catholic morality of sexuality and did something new with them. The theology of the body is something that's new. It's old and new because he's taking problems. He's a 20th century philosopher, you know, and he's taking questions from 20th century philosophy and he's looking over Genesis and he comes up with a new way of expressing the beauty and the meaning of the body and Catholic sexuality. All right. So the point I'm making here is that the big problem is people confusing the packaging with the content. And so, you know, you can't have any other music than Gregorian chant and traditional hymns. Well, you know, quite frankly, you know, if you know the history of the church, Gregorian chant didn't come around until about the 8th century, you know, the way we have it now. Music before that, you know, we didn't have musical notation until the 4th century. So, you know, there's only so much we know about it. But it was different. It was much more Greek sounding and Eastern sounding in its tonalities. Gregorian chant is something new. Polyphony was something new. It took, you know, polyphony was a change from Gregorian chant. I love that, you know, but using contemporary forms of language and of cultural expression has always been part of the church's life. And so you can't freeze the church in the 9th century or in the 1950s. Now, when it comes to doctrine, this is part of the role, the beauty of the Catholic Church. We have a magisterium. We have a teaching office that's authoritative in the bishops and the pope. And fundamentally, we have a lot of freedom to do stuff and experiment. And basically, the umpires, as we play this game of the joyful game of sharing the gospel, of doing new things, the umpires who cry foul are of the magisterium. So we have a safeguard. You know, we're trying our best to be faithful. But as long as we're submitting ourselves, our work to the bishops and to the Holy Father, you know, we have a certain safeguard, you know. And there needs to be a freedom that we give each other as well as in this whole process.
One of the things that I that just kills me about the way that Christian culture, this isn't just Catholic, but this is the way that Christian culture itself has developed in the West, in the Protestant church as well, but where in a lot of ways everyone is witch hunting each other to seek out who's the most orthodox and who's heretical, right? Like there's this, if we see somebody that we think is being off, we need to call them out as heretics as soon and as loudly as possible. And that will ultimately preserve the tradition or whatever. I'm not sure exactly what the major motivation behind it is. Maybe it's just that we feel our own sort of paradigm being threatened by someone else who's out there doing something that is different or outside of that paradigm. But I feel like there's no way that people are going to have the freedom to be creative with their approach to bringing the church into the world if they're always scared of being cast out as a heretic if they make something that's new or try something different. Like how can we as a church, how would you advise approaching that problem?
Well, I think, you know, it's entirely legitimate if you see a problem with somebody else's writing or you know, the tack they're taking, to say that you think there's a problem with this. But to basically assume responsibility of the Pope and say they're a heretic is going too far. So the dialogue between scholars, between artists, between evangelists about what they think is good needs to be respectful. And this has gone on for 2,000 years. This is nothing new, man. The Pope many times has had to get in. Part of his job is a referee to guarantee legitimate diversity and to draw the lines. And he's had to get in, and, you know, in the past, Dominicans and Jesuits were at each other's throat, calling each other heretics. And the Pope said, okay, guys, if you go outside these lines, you're heretics. But don't you dare call each other heretics as long as you stay within these lines. There's a lot of things that are, you know, fair game. You can have differences of opinion. Okay. And so the Pope's had to do that. He's had to, I think all of us need to just have some respect for each other when it comes to the way we critique each other. Critique's good. We grow through critique, but it just needs to be respectful and, you know, somewhat humble, it seems to me.
So who are some of the examples of early church fathers that have really created images and stories for you that are models for your life and inspirations for how you approach this problem of enculturation, of creativity, of evangelization?
There's so many. I think everyone here knows of Augustine. But I'm just going to give the example of Augustine is important because Augustine is continually read, has been continually read in secular college campuses. And the reason why is because he begins with his own problem, his inner problem of his own brokenness. He's incredibly introspective. He doesn't start with the cosmos trying to prove God. He basically starts with his own brokenness and sees God as the answer to his own need and his own brokenness, which is where most modern people start with the problem of I'm lonely, I need love, I need affirmation, I need meaning in my life. And Augustine in his confession starts right there. He's so passionate, he's so real, and he's so honest about his own brokenness. Can you imagine a bishop today writing a confession, you know, a few years after his consecration where he's open about his sexual addiction prior to his conversion.
No, I could never imagine that.
Yeah, and you know, and his ambition, you know, and just love of advancement of his career and love of vanity. I mean, he the fact that he was using the woman that he lived with, that he never really was committed to her, you know, that it wasn't true love. I mean, it's pretty amazing. He shares all that stuff, and it created a furor in the late 4th century when it came out. You know, there was nothing like it that had come out before. But
was he criticized for that?
Like, oh yeah,
in the church.
Oh yes, he was. There's
for
a guy
oversharing.
Well, you've probably heard of Pelagianism, but a guy, a monk named Pelagius, says, Augustine, you're just giving an excuse to every sinner out there. Oh, I can't help myself, you know. No, you can help yourself. Just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You've given free will, you know. And this guy, Pelagius, basically saw grace as a bonus that God gives to the people who help themselves. You know, God helps those who help themselves. Augustine says, nope, God helps those who can't help themselves, and I'm living proof of that. So Augustine just really, you know, deals with this brokenness of the human heart. You know, he's the one who helps develop the doctrine of original sin because he experienced it, you know, the woundedness of our nature. So I think everyone can relate to Augustine. And so he's awesome for apologetics, real apologetics, not just starting with the cosmos or starting with historical proofs, but starting with, you know, me and my need and you and your need and how the Lord fulfills that need and how he's transform my life. So to me, you know, Augustine is a great example of, you reach back into the past and you find things that are amazingly relevant to right now and the problems that we're facing right now, and trying to win back a generation that's jaded and thinks they understand Christianity and, you know, have rejected it.
Who are some other people that you see as models and good stories for this?
Well, there's an amazing guy that we don't know. And he wrote a letter addressed to someone named Diognetus. And this guy is an amazingly cultured Christian who's also, he knows the ancient world. He's writing around 125 AD. It's the first time after St. Paul that we have somebody addressing a pagan and trying to explain the church. And he starts and says, you guys have three questions about us. What's the source of the love we have for each other? Why this new way of life has appeared at this point in history. He kind of lists out three questions that pagans are asking, and then he responds to those questions. And he doesn't quote the Bible, because the pagans don't use the Bible. He uses their frame of reference, their categories. And one of the things he says, it's on my website, crossroadsinitiative.com. It's called Diognetus. If you just Google, you know, or search on my website, Diognetus and soul. He says, you know, you guys talk about the body and the soul. You know, Plato talked about that. The Stoics talked about that. And, you know, you realize that the soul really has the body's best in, without the soul, the body can't live, right? The soul is all about loving the body. But sometimes the soul says no to the body's pleasures, and the body doesn't like that and rebels against the soul. Well, Christians are like the soul of the world. And he has this beautiful, you know, analogy, this great classic reading that is, you know, just like a page long, but everyone should read this. And he says, you know, we look like you. We don't have distinctive clothes and dress. We don't huddle together like, you know, not, like a cult or a sect. We live among you. And we do a lot of things like you guys do. But there's a lot of things we don't do. We're really different in a lot of ways. And we share our food with each other, but we don't share our wives like you do. We don't expose our infants. You know, abortion was tried back then, but it wasn't very successful in all cases. So babies, unwanted babies, were left out on street corners to be picked up by passerbys or die by through exposure. So the early church was very clear, we're not going to, you know, maintain some, you know, Judean Aramaic culture that's distinct from you guys and live in a little ghetto. But at the same time, we're not going to live your immorality either. You know, there's a new way of life. And he's proud of the distinctiveness of Christian morality. He's proud of the loving of one another. He's proud of a different kind of sexuality that's not debasing, but it's ennobling, you know. And he says this stuff. It's a fascinating example. Like, the very first thing we have addressed to a pagan, gives us principles on how to deal with our own world and talk to our own world.
Yeah. One of the ways that I feel like in my own experience of Catholicism and trying to live that out in the world, I mean, I grew up, obviously,
with great parents,
fantastic dad, you know, especially. and I mean, you're teaching at UD. We were in a very Catholic bubble. Like the people that I was exposed to were all Catholic speakers, like Father Mitch Pacwa or whoever. And whenever I went to public school, like that was such a traumatic experience for me because I didn't know any of the language, and so much of it was like foul. And it felt like to me, to fit in, I couldn't live the way that I lived in the house. And there was just these like two separate worlds that existed, and they were divergent, like incompatible with each other. And as I've grown, those incompatibilities have led to this like maturation where I don't see everything as black and white and as rigid anymore, and have been much more of like entered into mystery with how I've looked at other cultures. But it's still a struggle for me. Sometimes I feel like I totally don't belong in the world. Sometimes I feel like I totally don't belong in the church. What do you feel like the ancients have to say to that sense of identity crisis?
Well, you know, the ancients are very clear that we're pilgrims. We don't belong in the world. You know, I mean, and there's different ways you can take this. You can take this to the extreme of being like the Amish and going off and huddling. And I think that's a, you know, bad move. I think it works great if you're called to close to religious life to go off into a countryside, a monastery. I don't think that that's the call for most of us, certainly not lay people. I think I've also felt many times not at home in you know, many places in church culture, you know? So I kind of understand your dilemma. But the reality is, to me, like the saints provide an incredible home base for me. They're really important in life. The true church is the church in heaven. I mean, the perfected church. And that sounds really crazy, but honestly, there's tremendous value in a lively awareness of the saints. I read the lives of the saints pretty constantly. It helps me a lot. And friendship and community is really important within the church to have, you know, friends, as long as that friendship and that community doesn't become a cult and a subgrouping, a subculture in the church that's, you know, closed and antagonistic. But I think it's the issue with the world is there's a certain way in which we're not of the world and can't participate in certain dimensions of the world. That's the way the early church was, you know, and when it comes to debased morality, you know. On the other hand, there's ways in which we got to be right in the midst of things. And it's a painful spot to be in at times. It might be a lot easier just to retreat maybe. But there's a tension that we see beginning in the very first days of the church and coming right up to now that we can't get around, that tension, the tension of being in the world and not of it. I just think that's the call for most of us, unless we're close to religious, is to grapple with that. And it's not over. It's like a lifetime discernment process, you know, on how to play that. And I think at different points in people's lives, you know, when I first had a conversion, I needed to really come away from the culture in certain ways. So I got very kind of monastic, and I thought I was called to be a friar, a Franciscan friar. I was a postulant for the Capuchins. So, you know, that was legitimate, that was good, that was helpful. And when I realized I had a call to marriage and a call to evangelization and to stay as a layman, of course, I had to make different adjustments. I had to get my mullet if I was going to go out and play in a 1980s band, you know. I had to be relatable, you know.
One of the things that I've been always sort of curious about, and I'm partly just sort of realizing I want to ask this as you've talked, but in growing up, it felt like our family was really in a very small Catholic conservative culture. growing up. Like that was my whole world and experience. Homeschooled, like going to the homeschooled groups and reading all the homeschooled books and altar serving and everything. And it felt like even how you dressed as like a professor was like super different than how you dress now. Like it feels like our family has really moved out of that bubble and is living in a much broader way in, I guess, in the world and encountering in culture. How did that transition sort of happen for you? And what were the difficulties that you had in navigating that?
Well, one thing I just say in defense of, you know, a certain kind of protection of our kids growing up, you guys, you know, I like this analogy. You build a ship in a harbor. You don't build it on the open seas, but you got to build it for the open seas. And at some point it has to go out to the open seas. It has to, you know, so I really think that unlimited access to our culture is a, you know, the culture has gotten so much more perverse than it was when I was growing up, in just terms of media's invasiveness, the porn that comes unsolicited, you know, on your news feed. Even you click on a news article and you have this big breasted woman, you know, with a lot of cleavage, you know, enticing you to click on the next link. So it's a really different world than 1960s, early 60s or something. So I think parents have to protect kids at the beginning. But I do think there's got to be a period of, there's got to be a way in which kids get integrated and have contact with the culture. And that's a challenging thing. I'm just going to tell you, probably you're going to have to go through this because you'll probably have kids one day. And it's not an easy thing to navigate. And it's like it requires prudence. And I'm sure we made plenty of errors and prudence along the way. But I just want to say that a certain amount of huddling together in the nest when kids are small is not a bad thing. But I'll just say for us that God called us to be engaged in the business world after I left full-time teaching in 2001. And that caused us to be in a much broader world with people who didn't share our faith. So it was really healthy for us. You know, it was a healthy move from that respect. And, you know, I'm teaching at a university, a conservative Catholic university. I'm not doing a lot of evangelization, but now I'm in the business world. I got to do more evangelization. I began speaking more in parishes of people who are not living a super conservative Catholic life, you know, Joe Sixpack, you know, sort of people in the pew. I've got to change my look and I've got to change my language. I can't be talking 60-cent, you know, theological Greco-Latin loanwords all the time. I got to use ordinary language. So, you know, that's really the transition that was made. It depends, I think, on your vocation, how you play this.
What were some of the ways that you felt that change in your language? Like, what were some of the moments when you were out in the business world and you felt the bubble kind of bursting and you're like having to learn a new language?
Well, it really wasn't learning a new language. It was just using old language before theology school. You know, which doesn't mean foul language because I had plenty of that in my storehouse. But you know, just talking everyday language and everyday metaphors and real life stuff, and translating that, you know, just to everyday speech. I find that to be a real problem in the church. I listen to so many homilies that I find so unrelatable and so boring, and because they're just not using everyday speech, everyday stories. You know, I was blessed. My dad was a great storyteller. So is my grandfather. And I think the art of storytelling is something that needs to be recovered. You don't hear it as much anymore. You know, people, at least I haven't seen people in your generation a lot sitting down and telling long stories, you know, or telling jokes. The nice thing about telling a joke is that oftentimes a joke is a story. So you got to be good at telling a story to tell a good joke. But, you know, those arts are not what they used to be. And I just think that for me, recovering that stuff that I knew and I had, and then, you know, fitting theological content into that rather than using, you know, analytical, technical, boring vocabulary from, you know, from academia to try to talk about the Lord, you know?
Mm-hmm. So as you got into the business world, what were some of the things that you experienced and learned as you were growing as an entrepreneur that you brought back to your teaching as a professor or as a speaker?
You know, I actually learned a lot about telling your story in business, because in business, we're trying to motivate motivate people to make business decisions, motivate people to actually work the business, do more. And the most motivating thing in the world is story, telling your own story. What your why? Why is it that you made your decision? Why is it that you're working the way you're working? What are you after? What motivates you? And that lights a fire in other people. So it's actually fascinating. I think everybody involved in Catholic ministry would do well to get some business training, because business is all about human nature. I mean, what makes people buy? What makes people pay attention? What makes people read? What gets people excited? I mean, it's basically has to be a study in human nature and human behavior. And so a lot of the business seminars, when it comes right down to what I recognized in the stuff I was learning in business, I recognized it all back in the teaching on the virtues by, people like Thomas Aquinas. But that's kind of buried in our tradition, So it's kind of interesting. Business training led me to go back and restudy the virtues. And I ended up doing a series on EWTN on the virtues, and I'm asked to speak about that a lot. But it's so powerful. It's like the kind of character of leadership, this faith, hope, and love, this character of a saint, but then this prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude. And that's really what every business seminar is about, when it comes right down to it. So anyway, it was really kind of cool that, business study and getting involved in business just helped me to rediscover some aspects of, again, of the rich Catholic tradition that's oftentimes sitting in books. And not being lived out and thought about a whole lot.
Why do you think that we're not seeing those in our churches and sermons and even in schools when we're learning theology? Like, why isn't that being adapted, the storytelling?
I think that, honestly, leadership in the Catholic Church is oftentimes thought of as too much of a professional enterprise where you go and take classes and oftentimes get an overview of doctrine, and that doctrine is really important. Don't get me wrong, classes are important. I'm still a professor. I teach at the Catholic Distance University online. You're all invited, by the way. So learning doctrine is important. Learning history is important, but leading a church, ministering to people, is not an academic exercise, and an academic degree doesn't qualify you to do that. And unfortunately, what could be studied also in terms of leadership development, management, group dynamics, communication, somehow isn't. And really that needs to be modeled. And lots of times priests aren't getting that modeled by other priests. And they're not getting critiqued either. So, and they're not just priests, it's, other people involved in ministry as well. But I'm picking on priests because, of course, that's who generally we're hearing preach. So if you're not hearing a whole lot about most Catholics get most what they're going to get, they're going to get in that Sunday homily, So the Sunday homily is really, really, really important. And we're not hearing a lot of great stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's typically missing from, a lot of preaching and also missing a lot of times from catechesis. So the virtues, character, the character development of leadership, the fact that we're all called to be leaders, we don't hear enough of that. And that's, business training is about leadership development, Even sales training is a lot. You're leading. If you're a salesperson, you're leading someone to make a decision. So it's leadership. All Catholics are called to be leaders. Now we're sheep, but we're all called to be shepherds. Most of us are called to be parents, or we're called to be shepherds, but we're called to be leaders in the marketplace, leaders in the neighborhood, leaders in school. Yeah, and the character of leadership, is the virtues. It's kind of laid out there, and that needs to be more modeled, more talked about.
Sure. Are there any things that you would recommend to someone that wants to learn how to communicate better, to tell better stories? Any comedians they should watch?
The best thing is to step out in faith and try to tell stories deliberately and try to tell a joke. It's a practiced art, but I wish I could tell you to listen to my father, but he has better things to do now. in the heavenly liturgy than model storytelling to you. But, I'm not thinking of anybody in particular. That was my model, was my father, my grandfather. So I certainly love listening to great storytellers. Like, his name slips
Something
me.
Red.
He's just, no, not Red Skull. Red Skull would be good. Yeah, some of those classic, I'll tell you what, a lot of the classic 1960s comedians, 50s and 60s comedians are awesome guys to watch. You know, it's kind of a neat cultural exercise. Go back and watch some of that stuff on YouTube. You know, Red Skelton is a guy. Yeah, Hal Roach is a guy I'm thinking about. You can get audio recordings of his Irish jokes and storytelling. So he's one of my favorites. I tell a lot of his jokes.
Cool. And so people should read those and then actually try telling them.
The
homework is like,
you gotta try
at dinner next time you're with your family, tell one of these stories.
But you know, I just have to say this, okay? Apologetics. A lot of people are into apologetics over the last, 20, 30 years. But communicating the gospel is more evangelism and it's more telling good news. And the good news is really how the Lord changed your life. So the most important story to tell is stories about how God has changed your life. You know, if you're talking to a Protestant about distinctively Catholic things, you know, how has Mary impacted your life? Rather than giving an abstract, dissertation on Marian theology based on scripture and St. Alphonsus Liguori or somebody, what's Mary meant to you? What's Eucharist meant to you? I think every Catholic, here's a homework I would like to ask. What's your story or what's some of your best stories about how God's impacted your life? Practice those. Share those. Write those down. Outline them. Don't write them down in written form because that's really wooden. An outline is good because, you can't just read it. But practice telling your particular stories about your conversion, about your faith, about the Eucharist, about Mary. That would be the most valuable stuff you could possibly do.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for, giving me life and then for coming on the podcast.
You are welcome, Anthony. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In 2016, we issued a call to creatives, entrepreneurs, designers, and artists from all over the continent to come together in Dallas because we believed that the time was right for a new renaissance to take place in the church. 85 of the most talented young Catholic leaders in the Americas answered the call, coming together because of this shared vision. And what took place at that summit was a flowering of community that was beyond description. And it is now clear that new Da Vinci's, Mozart's, Michelangelo's, Beethoven's, and Medici's are being brought together to blaze new trails for the gospel, to build new businesses, ministries, and works of art that will be catalysts for massive culture change. And if you are listening to this, then you have also answered this call, and we are so grateful for your participation in this movement. If you want to hear more from the speakers, participate in monthly professional development webinars, and be publicly represented on the Catholic Creatives website, you can make this happen by supporting us on Patreon. Your support and your commitment are vital for the growth and mission of Catholic Creatives. And the rewards are awesome. So your help means everyone can benefit even more from our community this year as we sponsor our creative projects and plan next year's summit. The time is right for a new renaissance, a counterwave of beauty. Our world needs aesthetically and philosophically articulate leaders, artists, creatives, and risk takers. Our world needs you. We'll look forward to hearing more from you in the community on Facebook and Slack, and at the regional meetups and at the summit. We'll see you there.